Hello and welcome to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. We're here to cover the Bitcoin news for Australia for the month of April. My name is Alex. With me again this month is Patrick. How are you going, Patrick?
Doing great, guys. Happy to be here again.
This month, we've got a special guest as well. We've got Daz B, all the way from sunny North Queensland. How are you going, Daz?
Hi, boys. Thanks for having me. Look forward to the chat tonight.
We brought Daz on. We decided we need an expert. Daz is probably the most prolific Bitcoin podcaster in Australia, I think, that can come to mind. So, yeah, we thought we'd bring in some real expertise to cover the news. It's been demanded.
I think I was saying to you boys offline, I rely on this podcast for most of my news, so I'll contribute where I can tonight. I'll be listening back to get all the little tidbits that you boys put together. Thank you.
We're going to start by covering a bit of price action. So Pat's going to lead us off today with price.
Well, I'm just wondering what the milestone we're celebrating this month is. What's Bitcoin done this time? Where are we at?
Well, we've crossed 100K a few times, haven't we? Up, down, up, down, up, down. I think we're down a bit at the moment, so, you know. Maybe not as optimistic, a bit of regulatory action, a bit of bad news, but we'll cover it all later in the pod.
Also a bunch of good news as well. There's a lot of reasons for the price to keep going up this month. Everybody's predicting some pretty crazy numbers. A lot of people are saying 100, 150,000 US dollars by the end of 2024. So I think it's always a good time to stack, but I think let's start really stacking at this point.
There's a lot of bullish inputs for the year. So I think some of those lofty targets for the year are absolutely warranted. And I think this cycle may very well prove to be one of the most bullish cycles we've had, particularly with, which we're going to dig into tonight as well, with all these ETF launches. The retail crowd normally are the catalyst for these big run-ups. If they can buy them at a click of a button, and there's more and more of those coming online, I think that's a real big catalyst for a real face-mounting bull cycle.
Yeah, just a few days ago, the Hong Kong Bitcoin ETF and Ethereum ETF was launched. So incredibly bullish.
Yeah, and there's been some news on the Australian front as well in terms of ETF movements. I think Monochrome has still put their application in and it looks like it's going ahead. I think the catalyst was always going to be the approvals of the US ETF. So I think Monochrome were waiting for the US ETF to be approved, which were approved in January. And we've seen some massive, massive inflows as a real catalyst to this run-up in the price action that we've seen to date. And, you know, I think that's only reinforced. So it'll be really good, I think, for the Australian market for it to have their own homegrown ETF. And hopefully that opens up some opportunity for people who don't necessarily run their own self-managed super funds to be able to get some access to some Bitcoin exposure through an ETF, through their traditional super funds. I really hope that those super funds lean into it.
Just for those who maybe they're not quite sure what an ETF really means for Bitcoin, can you break it down, Daz? Just simple terms.
Yeah, ETF stands for Exchange Traded Fund. So these are packages that basically get you exposure to a lot of different investment vehicles. Traditionally, you know, there's index funds, there's commodity funds, there's metals, energy, all of these types of funds where you can put a little bit of trust necessarily into an institution to go through and give you some exposure to a lot of these different investment vehicles. But essentially what it means is that a lot of ordinary people who are used to getting access to investment vehicles through their stock brokerage accounts can basically get exposure to the Bitcoin price via a click of a button. Now, we always advocate for continued learning and to really understand what makes Bitcoin valuable. And while you invest through an ETF, you're not actually owning Bitcoin, you're owning a claim to Bitcoin. And that's a really clear distinction and a really important distinction. But ultimately, it does give people who are perhaps not as interested in going down that route of the full learning journey just yet, does give them some exposure. And I think it's a good thing. It's a good catalyst to perhaps get people curious.
The thing that stands out to me is in terms of trying to figure out what this means. Things are different, but you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. What does this mean in terms of like the type of hodler that's going to be holding Bitcoin? I see people saying that, you know, potentially it's easier for people to get access to Bitcoin. They're more likely to drop it if things turn the other way. But at the same time, if we're giving ease of access for institutions move slowly and they're not going to be dropping things at the smallest change of wind.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point because, I mean, on one hand, you know, we focus the discussion on the retail investor and the fact that you can push that button and get access to Bitcoin a lot easier. And that is one aspect. But I think you're right. I think the real movement is in and around the institutional adoption. So there's a lot of formal, you know, institutional funds, hedge funds, pension funds, all of these traditional investment asset allocators who potentially can also now start packaging up Bitcoin in terms of their offerings, so they can really revisit their governance models in and around how they allocate capital. And I think having an ETF available, having the option for them to get exposure to Bitcoin at that click of a button, it's just as easy for them as it is for the retail investor. I think it's a real game changer. I think that then you start to imagine, when you start to think about the available capital that could potentially flow in, just a small percentage of these global assets flowing into Bitcoin, getting some exposure, that when that inflow comes in at the margin, you know, there's been some crazy multipliers sort of touted around, like 118 for every dollar that flows in, it'll move the Bitcoin price by 118. I don't necessarily buy into that, but you can imagine, like, even at, if you take a conservative number of that, like 20, for example, if you've got a $300 trillion bond market who can now all of a sudden revisit through some of these other institutional products that are sort of getting about. I don't know if you boys have heard the latest podcast from our good friend Peter Dunworth, but some of these institutional products that they're looking to package together, some of this financial engineering, which could potentially tap into that $300 trillion bond market, that will do some god-awful results to the upside on the Bitcoin price. So the catalyst is there. The interest is there. And I think it's only a matter of time before some of this very serious capital starts flowing into the space.
It does seem like we're hitting the mainstream. Is this the start of the S-curve, do you guys think? Is it about to kick off? Maybe the four-year cycle isn't going to hold much longer.
Yeah, and that's a really good point too. I think this cycle is the last that we see the really big swings in volatility, because where this the institutional adoption and the capital allocation and the way that they have to manage those exposures will create a natural rebalancing of their portfolio. So as Bitcoin starts to appreciate in price, they have to rebalance off. Their governance model says we're allowed 5% of exposure to Bitcoin, for example, and then the way that Bitcoin behaves, that 5% quickly turns into 10%, 15%, 20%. Those institutions are forced to sell. So that selling pressure then comes back in. But what that does over time is it irons out the volatility, which the traders will hate, but the mum and dads will love, because, you know, they can't stomach the volatility. They want a little bit of smoothing out. And the more capital that flows into this, the less volatile it becomes. However, it's a finite asset with increased demand, with diminishing supply and a predictable supply. So when you look at price, it is always met between the equilibrium between supply and demand. So that essentially means number go up over a long period of time. So while the volatility will iron out, the big swings will iron out, that's only going to self-reinforce more adoption, because now all of a sudden it's not as hard to stomach.
This is what the process of monetization looks like, right? So I guess, would it be safe to say you're bullish?
I reckon that's a safe bet, boys.
He's bullish. Pat, did you have anything else on price action before we move on to exciting news of the month?
I guess one more bit of good news is that, in terms of the lofty expectations, we actually have never hit, in Bitcoin's history, have never hit the all-time high from the previous cycle before the halving. That's a bit of a mouthful.
Yeah, that's true.
We seem to be either quite ahead of the timeline, as people might expect, or this really is some start of the S-curve and things are going to get really interesting.
Yep, we can only wait and see.
We can only dream.
It's going to be an exciting ride.
Yeah.
Well, onto the halving. So last weekend, about 10 a.m. on the 420, 20th of April, we had the halving block come in. It was picked up by VBTC, one of the Bitcoin mining pools. Block subsidy was halved from 6.25 down to 3.125 Bitcoin is the block subsidy. Fees came in at a whopping 37 Bitcoin, or slightly over, which gives us a total Bitcoin block reward of 40 Bitcoin for that halving block. As all the spammers, you know, everyone's spamming, competing to get their, you know, their name, their inscription, or their, a lot of people competing for the, or the miners themselves are competing for the ordinal, all that other nonsense into the block. So the ordinal itself, for those that have cared enough to at least find out what ordinals is, was auctioned off by VBTC for over 33 Bitcoin for that single ordinal relating to the halving block. That brought the total block reward up to over 73 Bitcoin. And that doesn't count any out-of-band fees that the mining pool miners have received as well, which we're not aware of or able to track. After the halving block, so the halving block was block 840,000. And then from block 840,006, We had further havoc with the launch of the Runes protocol, which is just, it's just more shitcoins on Bitcoin. If you don't know about it, don't worry about it. And we saw some very high fees sustained for days afterwards. What did you guys think of that? Did you guys watch the block come in? I scrambled to get my node back up. My node ran out of space. I was running on 1 terabyte SSD and it ran out of space a couple of weeks ago. So I scrambled to get it up. It's got a fresh 2 terabyte SSD in it. I watched that halving block came in.
I was at kids' soccer halfway through a soccer match, so I missed it drop in. I did have my phone and the mempool on sitting in the chair, but got a bit distracted with the kids' soccer. So I missed it. I missed it drop in, but we went and caught up with some Bitcoiner, local Bitcoiners down at the Esplanade here in Cairns and had a steak to celebrate. So that was a good day. But interesting, those fees, man, it was crazy. It was absolutely crazy to look at. Mm. I think if anything, it prompts Bitcoiners to start learning about UTXOs again, because that will be relevant. It'll keep popping up. It's definitely worth your time to have a little bit of a dig around about UTXOs. And basically, just to keep a long story short with that, it's just making sure that your Bitcoin is spendable into the future. And when we think about future fees, all you really need to understand is, do we expect demand for on-chain transactions to increase in future? And if demand is increasing, then that's a very logical conclusion to get to. So it's a worthy thing to be looking at and thinking about for all Bitcoiners is this notion of UTXO management. But in saying that, really, really cool to see really high fees for miners. High fee environments are great for miners. It makes sure that they're well capitalized and everyone got a share of that pie to help them carry through over the next few months. So what we typically see after a halving event is a bit of a price drop because miners are now no longer getting as much Bitcoin as they once did, and they become forced sellers of Bitcoin. So any Bitcoin on their treasury will normally have to be forced sold. You know, a lot of the undercapitalized miners will have to capitulate. They'll have to start selling some miners. So we normally see a little bit of a dip straight after a halving before the demand sort of starts to put that constraint on the diminishing supply. And that's normally the catalyst for a bull market. Like you boys rightly said, we've never seen the Bitcoin price hit an all-time high before the halving. So it'll be interesting to see how this carries through over the next few months, because they just made bank. All these miners, if you're lucky enough to mine a block in the last couple of weeks, they've made a lot of Bitcoin. This is the thing about the runes and all of the shit coins on Bitcoin. I firmly believe that, you know, that eventually, I mean, it might take a while. Alex, I know you've got your own views on this, but they will run out of Bitcoin. The beautiful thing about the Bitcoin protocol is those fees are paid in Bitcoin. And if you are not providing value in society, you will not earn Bitcoin. So you will run out of Bitcoin. So if you're going to play these games and put all these shit coins on Bitcoin, it might take a while. These guys probably have tapped into some fiat capital as well. So it might take a long period of time, but just rest assured that over a long period of time, I believe they run out of Bitcoin before I run out of patience.
Yeah, it certainly imposes a severe cost on them, much more than if there was no fee involved in spamming the network. So you'd have to definitely have deep pockets to continue it for any length of period of time, which is, it's a very important DOS measure that protects Bitcoin.
Sure. And it's healed already. We had a couple of weeks of really high sustaining fees. And, you know, today I saw fees as low as 15 sats per VBot, so well within a normal range again. So panic station's over. I'm sure we'll get some other spikes as we carry forward. But yeah.
I guess some of the things that stood out to me really from watching that whole, I guess, that whole outcome was just what happens when fees are so high for particular blocks. So if you've got a 70 Bitcoin value on the halving block and then the subsequent block, maybe if it wasn't for runes, only worth, say, the block subsidy, which is now 3.125 plus a small amount of fees, what does that mean for miner incentives? And so for those that were skulking around on Bitcoin Twitter in the couple of weeks leading up to the Bitcoin halving, there was quite a bit of speculation about the potential for what's known as a block reorg. And so when miners find a new block, they're adding it to the blockchain, but it's really at their discretion which blockchain they add it to. And it's in their interest, it's in their economic interest to add it to the chain that has the most proof of work, because that's what the nodes will follow. But there's nothing stopping them from mining on a different chain or even invalidating a previous block if it's in their interest. And so what's also been revealed this week was a degree of mining centralization that I think a lot of people haven't necessarily been as aware of. Mononaut, who is another great Twitter personality, did a bit of investigative reporting. He's famous for digging around in the mempool. is also a great contributor to the mempool.space open source project. And he has sort of linked together a whole bunch of facts around the way that block rewards are being paid out and the addresses they're being paid to link together a whole group of mining pools together. It looks like around 47% of the global hash rate is really participating in what could be considered almost like a mining pool for mining pools. It was sort of revealed that Antpool has been acting as a bit of a pool of pools, and that it seems like they have around 47% of the hash rate using their block template and their mining pool, but distributed across a whole bunch of pools, such as Binance Pool, Poolin, EMCD, Raw Pool, Ultimus Pool, and then also possibly Brains. And so it looks like there's been a whole bunch of mining pools that appear to be separate independent mining pools, and in reality have all sort of been drawing from the same block template, which gives them a lot of power for block creation. And at a time when fees are very volatile, block fees are very volatile, that gives them the power to potentially reorg the network with a good high percentage of likelihood.
A couple of things just to highlight that. So the more hash rate you have, the more chances you have of being pulling off a successful reorg. So basically what that means is you can go off network, you can solve many blocks in a row, and then if you end up being the longest chain, you can basically broadcast back to the network, and the nodes will normally follow the longest chain. So that allows you, if you've got a lot of hash rate, you can then start to do these reorgs. So potentially what that means is transactions three or four blocks deep potentially could get reorged and not necessarily committed when that chain gets rebroadcast back in, and the tail or the blockchain that they've been working off basically gets disregarded because now we have a longer chain to reconnect back to. And where that is probably really problematic then, where this centralization of hash rate, is that these pools then can dictate the templates that everyone else works with. So these templates are orchestrated. They'll normally pull the transactions out of the mempool, put them into a template, and then give those to miners to go and solve the blocks. So they're providing that template. And that's really the danger in this centralization of hash rate, is in and around them dictating the rules broadly for the rest of the network on what templates, what transactions are included. So that's where I think Ocean is playing a really critical role in being able to, and Stratum V2 is going to allow more of these miners. You can still contribute to a pool, but then you can work off your own template. You can very much dictate the rules. We can start filtering out these things like spam and shitcoins and monkey JPEGs on Bitcoin. So, and that's better at the miner's discretion than it is at necessarily a centralized pool distributing that template to everyone else. Still not a major concern at this stage, and I think that only improves with the protocol changes that we're seeing with various options for miners to opt out.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I think the outlook on this is quite optimistic because we've got some strong technologies that are going to help improve the situation. But I think the one thing that is important to mention is that Bitcoin doesn't just fix itself. It's the best way to say this. Bitcoin doesn't just sort itself out. It's through the actions of individuals like users, miners, node runners that Bitcoin is resilient. And so when we do start to see these kind of high levels of centralization, it's the actions of individual miners that resolve these issues and ensure Bitcoin's long-term success. As Stratum V2 gets rolled out, I really hope we see widespread adoption of that. And we've also got sort of some novel pools like Demand Pool, which is trialing Stratum V2 right now. I know Brains Pool has just rolled out Lightning Withdrawals, which helps to reduce sort of any type of custody of block rewards. Ocean Mining's just announced Lightning Withdrawals as well. And they allow for a choice of template at the moment. So these are all great things to hopefully see miners support. All right, let's move on to some Australian news. Pat, what have you got for us?
So we have a little update to the Julian Assange case. We were waiting for some assurances from the US government that Julian Assange would be safe if he was sent back over there. He's currently over in Britain, and he's been under house arrest of sorts for quite some time, but he's actually been put back into jail for his fifth year. So there was the decision being made to send him back in order to convict him of foreign espionage, which is actually a contentious situation because he has not done anything differently from the mainstream media. He is just providing information. He hasn't actually broken any of those laws, according to his defense lawyers. And the U.S. is saying that he is not covered under the First Amendment rights because he's not a U.S. citizen.
And so, sorry, what's happening on May 20th?
That's when the decision will be made whether he can appeal his extradition. So whether he can actually continue to fight his deportation to the United States to be charged. And yes, as I said, there are fears for his safety over there.
It was one of the first catalysts for the trend of weak journalism. You know, that's all, essentially all he did was be a journalist, discovered documents, reported on some pretty abhorrent behaviors in and around some governing bodies globally, US centric. But, you know, that's he's completely ruined his life just from speaking truths. And I think that was the start of, if not one of the major events in this sort of downward trend of journalists not being safe.
And on the topic of journalists, we have the Australian eSafety Commissioner story. The eCaren has been taking X to court. They're in federal court at the moment because they refused to take down a video, the stabbing of a religious figure. And actually, Meta was hosting the same video, and they complied with the eCaren, the eSafety Commissioner. X is refusing to play along, claiming that the law is overreach, and they are refusing to pay the $782,500 fine for each day that the video remains online.
Yeah, it's been quite the saga. We've seen almost every mainstream politician, mainstream Australian news organization come out and denounce X, obviously, as their main competitor, denounce X for their abhorrent support of violence and, you know, that evil freedom of speech. So it's just definitely be interesting to see how these court cases get resolved. What also has been really interesting to see is that the bishop actually himself, who got stabbed, he was subject to that attack, he has come out very strongly in support of freedom of speech. He released a pretty specky video, it's a pretty high quality video, talking about the importance of freedom of speech for the freedom of religion. And then he also, his first sermon, which was, I believe, earlier this week, he also dedicated towards freedom of speech and speaking on these topics. He's made statements in support of X's actions. So it's interesting to see for sure, because it's not often that you get that kind of support.
The ABC News covered setup of a new Bitcoin facility all the way out in regional Western Australia. That must be difficult. So they're actually launching this right after summer, which is clever timing.
I found the article quite interesting, actually. It seemed like they tried their best and they came up stumps a little bit. They tried to punch down on Irene, which is what formerly known as Iris Energy, which is the large US but Australian headquartered and led miner. And so they sort of indicated that since their IPO, that their stock has dropped right down. They're quoting stats that make it seem like Iris Energy is in trouble, which is not the case, or it doesn't appear to be the case at all. However, they talked to a couple of economists, very mainstream economists, and not a fan of Bitcoin, but one who pushed back quite well, I thought. And he pointed out that he's an empirical economist. He believes in empiricism and look at the facts and the evidence. And as far as he's seen, you know, they've been telling him that Bitcoin's a tulip bubble since 2013, and it's still here. So what does that mean?
Yeah, they cannot stop it. Another article circulating regarding Australian mining from bitmain.com, actually, they're reporting that Australian firm Archon Energy is tripling its capacity to 300 megawatts, which is almost half of the biggest Riot Platform site out in Texas. And they're actually buying existing sites from a blockchain data center consultant, Saber56, who will run all of their operations from now on. This seems a little bit strange to me, Daz. What's your take on this?
Yeah, look, I think that's a lot of power. I think, though, more and more ancillary services are a must-needed aspect of our grid and future grids, and that's where Bitcoin is really playing the part. So being the main purchaser of spare and wasted energy that's otherwise not capitalized, not generating any revenue, but it's ultimately the best controllable and scalable at scale. So we're talking big numbers here. That's the key part, is how do you introduce large loads into an energy grid, but also controllable loads that we can turn off on the dime without affecting the underlying. So when you contrast that to other data centers that often get touted, like a Netflix or an Amazon Web Services, real world utility that's tied into the uptime of those servers, whereas Bitcoin can very much handle it. And I think that's where a lot of these grid utilities are really starting to open up. And there's another story later on with more countries starting to tap into this, because it is a way of introducing a new revenue model into your energy grid to make overall prices cheaper. And that's really the game changer.
I did a bit of a disservice to Daz by not giving him a massive introduction. He's done about a million things in his life and interesting things. He's got a wealth of information and knowledge. I assume that everyone knows him because he, as I say, is the most prolific Bitcoin podcaster in Australia, probably. One of Daz's big strengths is his knowledge of the energy grid. Daz worked as an electrician on the energy grid in Queensland for a long time. He's also studied an electrical engineering degree. One thing that I've heard you talk about previously, I don't know if you ever recorded this somewhere, but in terms of the similarity of at least Australia's east, the grid on the eastern seaboard compared to Texas and what that means. Like, what do you think are the similarities between the grid on the East Coast and Texas?
Traditionally, grids are very expensive, particularly when you want to get power to people in really remote locations. So it's very capital intensive. And traditionally, what we've seen throughout the world is a lot of them are funded by government. So Queensland's a great example. We've got 64,000 kilometres worth of poles and wires out in the middle of the bush that only service 4% of our customer base. That's not a very attractive value proposition for a private company. So that's where we've ended up with a lot of infrastructure owned by government. I think when you contrast that back to Texas, I'm not sure what their history is, but a lot of the generators and a lot of the utility and the grid operators there are private entities. And when you're dealing with a private entity, that conversation becomes very evident quickly, because most of the time they're driven by profit and answering to their shareholders, where you contrast that back to a government entity, a heavily regulated entity like the Australian energy market, which is an interconnected grid right from the tip of Queensland right down to Tasmania and into South Australia. And it's mostly government funded, government run, government owned corporations. So they've often got other drivers that makes that conversation in and around introducing another revenue model into that. There's more barriers to entry into that conversation. I think a lot of that then, when you're talking about Bitcoin specifically, is this notion that it's still deemed a scam more broadly by government entities, and they can't be seen to be entertaining that, right? And I think if anything, just circling back to an early conversation around the ETFs and the ETFs in the States in particular, I think if nothing else, it helps legitimize Bitcoin as a legitimate asset and starts to help shift that conversation. It becomes a bit more palatable to be able to have that conversation. I'm really quite hopeful for those conversations with energy grids. And I think when people start to understand introducing Bitcoin mining into an energy grid, what it actually does for consumer bills, that's the game changer. And I think people will scream for it and demand it. That's the type of reaction we'd like to get from the population. Once that education is around there, as you are contacting your member of parliament, and you say, I need this for our grid because it means I get cheaper bills.
I think you had told me previously that maybe it's like the way the energy pricing is done in Australia. Is that similar? Or
it'd be very similar. Yeah, negative pricing is a real issue. There's a whole heap. I could probably spend half an hour talking about that if you're keen.
Okay.
Special episode sometime.
Let's wrap up some Australian news. So I just wanted to sort of make a bit of an announcement about a couple of upcoming events we have. So first one is, well, we don't have any dates for this, actually. This is almost just rumor at this stage, but Peter McCormack, who I'm sure you're familiar with from the What Bitcoin Did podcast. Well, first, he has a football team, that Real Bedford, have just won the league and they'll be promoted next year. But secondly, he's announced that he's coming to run his Cheat Code conference, which has just been run in the UK. He's going to be running an Australian edition. And so the expectation is that that will be running sometime either later this year or very early next year, with no dates as of yet, but something to keep in mind, something to keep your ears out for. It'll be probably a very good conference if it is put on. Obviously, Peter's profile means that he's likely to draw on a couple of, at least a handful of very high profile guests if he does go on it. The other event, we've got the man himself here to shill it for us, is the Bitcoin Bush Bash, which is happening up in Palm Cove, which is near Cairns, just on the very edge of Cairns, in the last weekend of July. So why should everyone get down to the Bush Bash?
It's close to my heart, this humble little Bush Bash that we have up here in Cairns. Very worth your while. So I think out of all the bush bashes, I'm definitely biased here. Take this with a grain of salt, but the Palm Cove bush bash is the one. If you're going to make the pilgrimage to a bush bash, you know, if you are in remote areas of Australia or you haven't been to one before, make it this one. It's very easy to get wifey, husband, significant other to come along, and you just say, hey, I'm going to just hang out with some weirdo Bitcoiner friends and just enjoy the beach and the sunshine, the rainforest, the reef for the rest of the week. We've got a jam-packed, lots of speakers coming out. For those who aren't aware of it, it's just a very chilled out, laid back event where Bitcoiners just put their hand up and say, I've got something interesting to say tangentially to Bitcoin. We hang around, we eat steaks, we have some beers, and we just enjoy each other's company. And it is absolutely one of the must-do things that any Bitcoiner in Australia needs to do is get to a bush bash, and why not make it the Cairns one?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. The bush bashes are like critical community building for the Australian Bitcoin community. I get to as many of them as I can. I think I've been to 6 now, maybe 7. I'll be there for Pump Cove. Daz will be there. Pat, I don't know if you're, is it crossed your mind to get a ticket up to Cairns for the end of July?
I'm not good at planning ahead, but, you know, 1 month out, I will be making my best effort to get up there. And just for people who don't know, you don't actually have to pay for a ticket. You just have to get yourself accommodation and get down to the venue.
Yep. So this one's held at the Palm Cove Surf Club.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so for those that are interested, you can look for more details, find Bitcoin Bush Bash on Twitter or bitcoinbushbash.info is the website. Let's push on to some global news. We've already discussed the halving and sort of the revelations around the potential mining centralization we're seeing. The other really big topic for this month that we'll be talking about is the Samurai wallet arrests. Where the US goes, Australia follows. So it's important to pay attention to what's happening in the regulatory landscape over in the US, because Australia is likely to adopt a lot of the same policies or frameworks. Not exactly, but very similar. So just the other week, we saw the arrests of the two sort of main drivers and co-founders behind Samurai Wallet. So Samurai Wallet is a privacy-focused Bitcoin wallet, and they also operate as a CoinJoin coordinator, where they facilitate coin joins, but critically, they don't take any custody of user funds. So for those playing at home, a coin join is a way of mixing funds. So it's a way to essentially obscure the origin or grant forward privacy for your Bitcoin, because the Bitcoin blockchain is fully transparent and you can see the entire history of transactions. And so what that allows people to do is basically track the movement of funds. And so a coin join is basically a collaborative transaction where instead of you making a Bitcoin transaction to pay someone or to move your funds somewhere, you collaboratively, along with a large group of other people, you all pay. So you all put your Bitcoin in and you all bring your Bitcoin out where you want it to go. And so that breaks these heuristics, which firms such as Chainalysis and other blockchain surveillance firms might use to try and track your funds. So Samurai are very focused on privacy, and as a result of that, have become targets. So what's happened? So they got arrested. They've been charged with facilitating money laundering, and as well as operating an unregistered money services business. As a result of this, we've seen several key players pull out of, well, and at least notionally, they're pulled out of operating in the US. So Phoenix Wallet, which is you're probably aware of, is one of the sort of most well-known Lightning wallet providers. They've decided to pull out of operating in the US. Also, ZK Snacks, also known as the Wasabi wallet team, who are also a CoinJoin privacy-focused wallet, they have pulled out of the US and operating, which is probably no surprise. And then we also had our Australian-based wallet. This was some time ago now, but potentially in anticipation of some kind of action like this, which was Wallet of Satoshi. They pulled out of operating in the US. I believe it was sort of mid to late last year. I've sort of forgotten the timeline on when that occurred. But yeah, and they've anticipated that. But what does this mean? Well, we can really expect this kind of enforcement to have a chilling effect on Bitcoin development and services. So if... maybe to jump back a step, but the fact that Samurai were operating as a CoinJoin facilitator or a coordinator, but they didn't take custody of user funds at all, that was sort of seen as like a bit of a red line that couldn't be crossed. Once you're taking custody of user funds, you're seen as a Mixer, mixing service, and you're sort of been seen as fair game for the US regulators. And actually in 2019, FinCEN, which is the regulatory body that provide guidance in the US, they had sort of indicated back in 2019 that the custody was one of the critical elements for something to be considered a money services business, which requires them to be registered. And with these arrests, we've sort of seen an indication that that guidance, which the whole industry has been basing their actions around, is going to be disregarded and potentially won't be held to have any effect. So it's interesting to see that on the one hand, regulators, you know, they provide guidance to potentially give regulatory clarity, and then at the same time, they can just disregard it as they want. It's interesting.
So, you know, there's been a lot of focus, particularly on Bitcoin Twitter, in and around this attack on custody, attack on privacy. And I think sometimes it's just important to strip back and just deal in the facts. And as I understand them anyway, is the fact that they have been charged with a very specific action, which is accusations around money laundering and being a money transmitter, whether that is true or not. And I think the other thing which they've come under fire a little bit is this notion of poking the bear. So they've publicly apparently come out, I haven't seen this with my own eyes, but apparently on social media have celebrating the fact that they've helped Russian oligarchs shift funds and these sort of things. And it's very, very blatant poking the bear, right? There's very strict laws in the jurisdictions that they operate within. And I think a lot of Bitcoiners are guilty with this, and a lot of Bitcoin services and a lot of Bitcoin companies are purposefully out there saying we are absolutely opposed, for right or wrong. But when they draw fire, I think it's definitely not warranted. I'm not saying that in any shape or form. Please don't take that out of context, but you can understand why they've come under fire if they've been, you know, publicly sort of saying we're going to shove this in your face.
Yeah, I agree. If anyone's interested, you can go and look up the information that was issued alongside their arrest. And in that was listed, and like there were screenshots of certain tweets they'd made. And you're right. No one said that separating money from state is going to be easy. It's going to be a difficult and long road. And there is a definite element of strategy involved, right? And I think some of the actions they've taken were definitely provocative. It's not really a surprise that we've seen them be targeted as sort of like the first ones, especially off the back of the Tornado Cash case as well.
And when you understand the fundamentals of what Bitcoin is, how Bitcoin works, and what Bitcoin is going to do ultimately, you don't really need to come out publicly to say it will happen. Yeah. Whether you're taking that unnecessary risk of poking the bear, you better watch out for the claws.
Announced today, actually, one of the co-founders, so Keon, has pleaded not guilty. So he was, I guess, charged today. Pled not guilty and has been put on house arrest with a $1 million bond. We'll obviously keep everyone updated on this as it proceeds. It's going to be a critical case that sort of really defines the landscape for the next few years, probably.
And I really hope the community gets behind them as well and supports them in that fact, because I don't agree with that at all. I think it's just important to underscore that they don't deserve to go to jail for what they've been providing.
Yeah, privacy is not a crime, and unregistered money services business is going to be the new unlicensed cryptographic munitions. I don't know, but I've forgotten the tweet. This is from Nick. I'm just copying Nick's tweet earlier this week. I thought it was good. Awesome. So that's that. It's a sort of unsettling development, but we'll keep you updated with where that goes.
Okay, so over to some more global news. We have the India Bitcoin Conference being announced. It will be happening in September, the 20th to 22nd in Goa. The speaker list is not available yet, but given their geolocation, I imagine there's going to be a fair bit of talent there. Obviously, one of the most populous places on Earth. It should be pretty special, I think. Chain Analysis have a new global adoption report from 2023, and it doesn't just measure the volume or the number of wallets, but it looks at a more fundamental level of the country's population and where people are putting their wealth. And India is ranked number one for Bitcoin adoption according to their metrics. So this should be... this should be a really interesting conference. NeutronPay raises $1.5 million in an investment round for their Lightning Network expansion in Southeast Asia. So I think it's important to say that they are fully licensed, they are fully regulated, which means they are KYC, and they are big believers in the Lightning Network, especially for international small payments and microtransactions with increased efficiency. So they are boasting about lower fees than credit cards, and there's no threat of chargebacks. They have a mobile app ready in Vietnam one of the countries adopting Bitcoin the most, and Canada as well. So they've got lots more on the way. They've got a point of sale solution and an API for businesses. So this is pretty bullish. Apparently they support over 34 countries and 8 different currencies. So they obviously don't think the Lightning is doomed. They think that there's some hope here, and they're really pushing for this as a payout or off-ramp service.
Yeah, this is really interesting to see. Might not be the direction that everyone's hoping or expecting to see with Lightning. A lot of people are hoping to see sort of like the more self-custodial and more private forms of Lightning come out. But I think it is interesting, if we maybe contrast this to what we've seen with Samurai and the coin joins, where their primary use case is around privacy. Well, Lightning it's a payments network, but it has privacy built into it. So in a sense, you can really think about the Lightning network as almost privacy by default. So it's a payments network. People are going to use it because it's more effective at being a payments network than the current alternatives, but it's going to come with privacy by default. And so when we see these sort of licensed regulator KYC services really pushing Lightning adoption, I think that's it's a real Trojan horse for privacy on Bitcoin. And in line with that, we've got some other news actually, which is that Coinbase has partnered with Lightspark. And Lightspark is another one of these sort of KYC highly regulated, well, they're aiming to be sort of like the highly regulated Lightning service provider. And they are partnering with Coinbase to roll out Lightning. And so Coinbase is planning to hold all the signing keys, but Lightspark will be operating their Lightning nodes on their behalf. And they're aiming to, quote, eliminate payment barriers and enable faster and cheaper Bitcoin transactions. So not even a mention of privacy there. It's really this Trojan horse. So I think it's really is quite a positive development to see this rise of the Lightning network within KYC and regulated services. Any thoughts on that?
I played around with the Lightning network a little bit. It's a bit of a messy basket. It's quite a lot to try and get your hands on. There's all sorts of trouble you could walk yourself into, and there's not really the resources to help you get out of it. So there is quite an appeal for somebody else looking after all of your Lightning needs, which, as you say, has a lot of trade-offs.
Yeah, I agree. I've run a Lightning node, opening Lightning channels over the last couple of years, and I think most people tend towards those custodial type of relationships to use Lightning, and that's got its own trade-offs, but they also serve a pretty good purpose, in my opinion, as long as you understand those trade-offs and you're not storing generational wealth with them, you know?
Yeah, agreed. I'm a huge fan of Phoenix Wallet. We've got our local legends, the Wallet of Satoshi, which is a custodial wallet. It's a great wallet to set people up or give Lightning a go if you've never tried it. And then Phoenix Wallet is kind of that sort of like next level up, where it's a self-custodial wallet. You hold the keys, but they manage the node itself. And then obviously the next step from there is to go fully self-sovereign and run your own Lightning node. It's definitely a little bit more technical. It's not unachievable for anyone that's got kind of like a slight technical bend about them. So I encourage you to give it a go for sure, especially while it's still relatively cheap.
Next, Paraguay proposes a temporary ban on Bitcoin mining, but then reconsiders. So according to an international agency study, Paraguay's energy mix is about 38% hydro, 33% from biofuels and waste, but they also rely quite heavily still on oil plants, which is a little bit out of the ordinary for most of sort of developing nations. So what I think is important here is that they've had over 50 instances of power outages in the region since February. So the government's turned its eye towards Bitcoin mining, because there's quite a lot of Bitcoin mining starting to concentrate, and other cryptocurrency miners starting to concentrate in and around those hydroelectric dams. There's senators have proposed entirely halting cryptocurrency creation, storage and operation for 180 days until proper legislation has been written, because at the moment there is no overarching mining regulations. And I think it's important to highlight the need for having some responsible regulation in and around when you are on a grid. So if you do have access to cheap grids, that excess energy on that grid can actually cause some significant disruptions to otherwise competing demand without the proper sort of regulatory framework to operate within, in particular around those controls, which we sort of alluded to earlier in this conversation today, around those ancillary controls, being able to signal to those miners that we've got some network constraints, you need to ramp down for us and provide that power back. And if the economics are right, that doesn't have to be an altruistic measure. That can be pure economics in and around how energy grids work and how energy pricing can flow between different market operators. And staying on some more mining news, Bhutan is apparently upgrading their mining facilities by 500%. So the country in the Himalayas has an investment arm called Druk Holdings. And the investment team's basically compensating for the halving is the alleged news item here. So they're partnering with Bitcoin mining solutions company Bitdeer Technologies. So Bhutan's been secretly stacking sats for quite a long time. I think it was only last year that it came out publicly due to some of the... Some of it might have been FTX or Celsius's holdings that this Druk Holdings.
I think it was BlockFi. They got doxed in the BlockFi documents.
So they got doxed in the publicly listed documents as holding Bitcoin on BlockFi potentially, and basically had to fess up at the time and said, yeah, we've been secretly mining Bitcoin with our excess power consumption. And I think that's the nation state play. It'll happen more and more. Mentioned a bit earlier, most of this infrastructure is quite expensive. So it tends to be in government hands. And I think once governments do actually wake up to the fact that they can sell this excess energy, and we've never been able to directly tie energy to a monetary good in history, and now we can, and that's called Bitcoin. And once they figure that out, that any excess or otherwise unused or wasted energy, that they can start tapping that and turn it into a monetary good, you watch hash rate just skyrocket through the roof.
So they hope to upgrade their facility to 600 megawatts, and that is pretty gigantic, isn't it?
That is a lot of power. I think the last time I looked, the city of Cairns demand was about 45 megawatts. So
you mean they're using as much power as the entirety of Argentina?
Yeah, well, you know, it often gets compared to that.
So Bhutan was actually boasting about their low cost to earn one Bitcoin, $20,000 per coin mined, which is pretty crazy. In more global news, Norway wants to curb Bitcoin mining with some data center regulation. They have actually promised that they will get around to investigating Bitcoin. They were having a bit of a go at Bitcoin mining for its energy issues, energy consumption issues. According to the Hashrate Index, Norway produced 92% of their electricity supply from hydroelectric power, which is the most in all of Europe, and which makes it even stranger that they would have such an issue with Bitcoin mining with such renewable energy sources. And the country accounts for less than 3% of global Bitcoin hash rate.
I believe it's our last global news topic, which is from El Salvador, and we've had a bit of a data leak. 5.1 million El Salvador citizens have had their private data leaked, including ID photos, and it's been put up for sale on the dark web. So apparently El Salvador has not met the perpetrator's demands, and so it's resulted in the records now being released for free. Along with this, there's also been an attack on the El Salvador Chivo wallet, which is the government-provided wallet that was released alongside the El Salvador Bitcoin rollout. And so we've seen details around some of the source code from that being leaked by these hackers, as well as details around some of the external services they were using for that wallet.
And so I think this highlights the caution that everyone needs to take in terms of digital IDs. Governments tend not to manage your data that well. We should not give them more. We shouldn't be celebrating giving them more. You know, they're very bad at IT.
They're quite good at things that are in their interest, and just protecting your data isn't necessarily, it's only in their interest to the extent that it gets them reelected. So something that I saw as well, there was maybe some Australian news that we didn't really highlight, but I'll just bring it up now, was that the Australian Taxation Office, the ATO, has actually struck a memorandum of understanding with the Indonesian Tax Office. So there's going to be data sharing around cryptocurrency purchases and transactions so that they can better capture tax within their respective jurisdictions. And so one of the things that Bitcoin is really going to do, and why we're so happy and so optimistic about the future with Bitcoin, is that it's going to realign those incentives for individuals, but also at a high governance level as well. Cool. On to some technical news. So this month we got the addition of 5 new Bitcoin BIP editors. So Brian Bishop, also known as Kanzua, Merch, Ruben Thompson, Walu, also known as Roast Beef, and John Attack were added as BIP editors. So does anyone want to break down what is a BIP in a couple of sentences or less?
Sure. So BIP stands for Bitcoin Improvement Proposal. And these are suggestions from the community shared on GitHub. So they collaborate together, they talk about them, raise issues. And if a proposal gets enough support, it will actually go through and be programmed, be coded up, and then potentially actually merged with the Bitcoin code. And these do happen quite often. It's not always a major release that changes a whole lot of things. It may just be a simple tidy up of code or even just some new test cases and things. So these happen quite a bit, and it's good to have more editors. It's always good to have more eyes who understand the Bitcoin code deeply, and if nothing else, can watch what new stuff comes in.
Yeah, it's good to see that all these five new editors are like extremely experienced developers in the Bitcoin space. Some of them working directly on Core, some of them in other areas like Wallo, for example, is involved with the LND implementation of Lightning. So yeah, really good to see such highly credible developers add on to that. With the five new editors, they're clearing out a bit of a backlog. They're working, looking back at BIPs that were proposed, or changes to BIPs as far back as, you know, 2020, I believe, or 2021.
I think it's important to highlight there's been recent debate around ossification of Bitcoin, whether it's net good to be, you know, encouraging changes or whatnot. And I think what's probably important just to highlight and underscore is that there are always maintainers for code. Any software system needs maintainers, and whether we're actively encouraging people to change Bitcoin, that's the debate in around this ossification. But I think what's really important to note is that developers need funding. You need to be incented to spend your time to point your skill set at Bitcoin and maintaining Bitcoin. It's not all accolades and roses and names up in lights. So if you made meaningful wealth out of Bitcoin, give back. There's a lot of open source charities that are available. You can get tax deductions on for donations like OpenSats, and they will deploy that capital to maintain on-chain developers.
Wholeheartedly agree with that. Brinks, another great one. If you want to give to Bitcoin developers, but you don't necessarily have a particular developer in mind, they sort of take on the burden of sort of assessing what work is being done and where funding is really needed in the ecosystem. So Block has announced that they're going to be developing a 3-nanometer Bitcoin mining chip. So for those that aren't aware, just microchips in general are sort of, I guess, described in terms of the size of the transistor. So it's currently, I think, the state-of-the-art Bitcoin miner, which is probably like a Bitmain Antminer. The most recent one, I think it's around the 5-nanometer level. In general, the sort of state-of-the-art at the moment is around 3-nanometer. So we've seen Blocks basically announcing that they'll be building their new miner at that 3-nanometer scale, which is, it's pretty impressive for them to come out of the gate on. What is the significance of having a smaller size? Really, it's just about efficiency. The smaller the transistor is, the more energy efficient it is, the less heat it generates, and I guess just the faster processor it is as well, just because everything's happening at a smaller level, so the electrons are literally traveling less far through the wires to go through the actual transistors themselves.
The actual process of silicon wafers and layering on actually need really, really stable geological locations, so you can't have any sort of seismological movement.
Like Taiwan?
Enough. Like Taiwan, it can cause significant disruptions to production when you have instability in the ground.
For those that aren't aware, there was a recent, reasonably severe earthquake in Taiwan, and Taiwan's famously the home of the Taiwan Semiconductor Facility, and so it's likely they've seen a significant amount of disruption around their production from that.
So is it just the chip, or are they building a whole ASIC?
They're building a whole ASIC, yeah. But
an ASIC, excellent, because the... We need some competition in this market. We need some more ASIC players. Earlier in April, there was a Bitcoiner get-together for the Tuscany Lightning Summit. We should have talked about this a little bit earlier, but the Tuscany Lightning Summit is dedicated to the development of the Lightning Network. And they were discussing some important implementations, a proposal by Australian Rusty Russell, who was the first to implement the Lightning Network. They were discussing problems of previous implementations of the Lightning Network, a lack of privacy, one-way invoices, even some problematic edge cases that we are now aware of. And they are proposing a new implementation of the Lightning Network. Ultimately, they are wanting to make the Lightning Network like cash. So the payments layer, where Bitcoin is the settlement layer, is an important step toward the progress of the Lightning Network, which may be making a bit of a comeback, it seems. Everybody's jumping on it.
Yeah. Well, the Tuscany Lightning Summit was pretty good. They have a live stream. They uploaded all the talks.
Bitcoin ASIC manufacturer Auradine raised another $80 million. They produce Teraflux Bitcoin ASICs and supported by venture capital firms and Marathon Digital Holdings. So they're known for their proprietary energy tune and auto tune technologies, and they're specifically targeting the energy grid, in particular the stability and demand response market. So really just underscore what you said earlier, Alex, just really great to see more competition in that space in and around ASIC manufacturing. And I think it'll be also interesting to see if we see another bull market in ASICs like we did last cycle. I mean, you can pick up a S19 for about $3,000 now, and they peaked, I think at their peak, there was about $16,000 for a S19 ASIC at the peak of the last bull. So it'll be interesting to see if ASICs themselves also experience a bull market in conjunction with the traditional Bitcoin bull market.
So that's all of our technical news. If you're a technical Bitcoiner and you're still here, I recommend you go check out the fantastic technical news recap, bitcoin.review. We like to give them a big shout out for doing the technical recap. So get yourselves over to their episode for some more tech news.
We've got Daz here, who is an expert in all things Bitcoin. And you know what Daz can help you with is eliminating single points of failure, setting up multi-sig and giving specialized advice on what wallets are suitable, hardware devices, this kind of thing. So do you want to show that before we jump off the podcast, Daz?
Yeah, I'd love to give it a plug. Thanks, boys. So as part of Looking Glass Education, obviously custodies are a really big concern for us, and we want to make sure that people are making informed decisions in and around custody. So more than happy to open that conversation up and invite anybody who wants to have a free consultation, 30-minute consultation in and around custody. We can certainly discuss what's important to you in terms of custody, a lot of different options, and there is a solution tailored for your personal circumstance, your home situation, whether wifey's on board, whether mother-in-law's on board, last will and testament, all of those types of things. And we work closely with the Bitcoin Advisor as well in order to be able to offer that service. They've got a phenomenal product in and around inheritance planning using their collaborative custody solution. So we can definitely assess your personal needs and see whether that's a good fit for you as well. So by all means, open up that invitation. Anybody wants to have a discussion, more than happy to spend the time and find the right custody solution for yourself. LookingGlassEducation.com, or just go straight to the Bitcoin Advisor. You can look for me, book a session direct.
Looking Glass Education itself, they're an amazing website you guys have put together along with Seb, and it's free, heaps of free resources, educational resources.
Yeah, so we put that together for wage earners, really. That's the target audience, is just everyday people who want to get a bit of an understanding in and around macroeconomics and finance. And that sounds dry, but I assure you it's more interesting than you think. We've got a free course in there called the Bitcoin Course. Part one is why you might like to consider Bitcoin and what it means for wage earners in terms of navigating through a fiat monetary system with debt and inflation working against you. And then part two of that course is actually our book. We co-authored a book, Seb and I, called Beers for Bitcoin, that's available on Amazon. It's really well received in terms of an approachable way for you to learn about how Bitcoin works. And that's part two of the course. So if you can afford the sats, we'd absolutely love the support. Buy the book, buy a couple and give them out to friends. But otherwise, it's free as well. It's part two of that course. You can get all that access by lookingglasseducation.com.
Awesome. Thanks heaps for joining us. It was a pleasure. He's got about a million other podcasts. You can probably search Daz and you'll find them easily on whatever platform you like to use.
I appreciate you boys having me on. Thanks. Thoroughly enjoyed the chat, lads. It was really good.
Good insights, Daz. Thank you for coming.
Pat, any closing thoughts?
Long live Bitcoin.
Long live Bitcoin, yeah. Yeah. The king is dead. Long live the king. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, well, thanks. Hopefully we'll see you next time. We'll be back with the news for May, maybe even sooner than that. A few people requesting us to push this to more of a fortnightly schedule. We'll take that on board and we'll have a think about it, and maybe we'll see us in a fortnight, or if not, be the end of May.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, boys. Yeah, sure.